Thanks so much to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. We're all developers here, and Sentry understands us. They know our code's broken, and they just want to help us fix it. In the perfect world, you'd be able to write a comprehensive test suite that covers every edge case in your code. But you know that's not the reality. You know that some user is going to take some action that you don't expect, and eventually you're just going to have to throw an error. Now, you could rely on the user reporting an error, but is that really the best experience? It's not only frustrating for them, but you'll end up with incomplete or misleading bug reports, and that's just going to waste the time of both your support and your development teams. So, Sentry is here to tell you about errors in your code before your customers even get a chance to see them. Their error reports include detailed contextual information to help you reproduce and fix the error, including a full stack trace, the commit where that line of code was checked in, and yes, even the developer to point the finger at. You can even get a breadcrumb trail that tracks the user's actions leading up to the error, so you can reproduce it without ever even contacting the user. And of course, Sentry integrates with your deployment pipeline, so you can catch errors before they even make it to production. They've got a bunch of first-party support for client and server-side platforms, including a couple of DNC favorites, Vue.js, Rails, and yes, even Elixir. So, head on over to Sentry.io to give it a try. They have a free developer account, which is perfect for personal projects and early-stage applications. Sentry.io. Your code is broken. Let's fix it together.
Oh, man. This week has been rough, and I don't even know why.
Verbalize it. What's up?
I'm tired. I'm sick and tired.
You've been busy.
Yeah, you know what? It's a few things, but yeah, I've been busy. Been real busy writing tests and fixing tests and things. But real quick, before I dive into this rabbit hole that I've picked out for this week, what have you been doing?
Yeah, we actually have a topic for today, so we're going to keep our little carousing brief here. Carousing? That's not the right word.
Rebel rousing?
We're going to keep our... yeah, we're going to keep it short here, and so we can get right into our topic. But I have some big news. I finally launched the quote-unquote beta of our new Nuxt front-end application to the world. Which is simultaneously exciting and terrifying. Yeah, it's one of those things you have to like mentally prepare yourself for, because you know you're so excited and you're like proud of your work, and you know as soon as you put it out there and tell people, hey, beat up on it, that you're gonna come wake up in the morning with a lot of feedback, better or for worse. And so, but. Like, I've spent the whole morning just going through it all, because the guys have actually been using it and giving really, really constructive, nice feedback. Nobody said, like, it sucks because it's different. Nobody said, you know, that it was worse, right? Like, everyone had, like, very specific things that they said, this doesn't work, this isn't how I like it, can you change this, this, and this? And I was like, sure, yes, okay. And then I created, you know, a dozen issues in GitHub. So, and the cycle repeats. So that was nice. The system works so far, and it's only been one day.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about that, to get people using it. And it feels kind of like a relief. Like, now I can actually focus on, you know, whatever comes next, and just kind of iteratively improve this. So it's kind of a weight off my chest, actually. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, that's awesome, especially to hear about not just a flood of negative feedback, especially. I don't know. I guess I tend to think that people, when they get really used to using something a certain way, I'm this way too, and something suddenly changes, it's really easy to pick apart the negative things and be like, I don't like this, I don't like that, just because it's different.
Yeah, definitely. And when a bunch of people say the same thing, then you know, like, that it's not just one person, right? It's like everyone's thinking it, and just a few people just happen to say the same thing. Like, a lot of people complain about the design. They're like, oh, it's too bright. And like, on one hand, you could take, you just chalk that up to, oh, it's different, they're complaining. But really, you know, maybe there's not enough contrast. It's I've just been staring at it for forever. But, you know, the UI could kind of be darkened and made more contrasty. So,
right,
like, stuff like that, you know, it's like they're not complaining. They're just offering feedback, which is what I asked for. So,
right, yeah.
It's great.
That's cool. Well, if you want some real negative feedback, let me know. Just let me in there. Yeah. I'm just kidding. I wouldn't want to do that. That's really exciting. I agree with it. I've seen a lot of screenshots and things and small videos of it, and it looks really awesome.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really excited. So I have a lot more work ahead of me now, but it's definitely coming along. And the other fun thing that I worked on just for a couple hours was I wanted to see if I could get the Elixir portion of the app running on GigElixir.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now it's hosted on EC2, a couple of EC2 instances that I had to manually set up and, you know, install and load balance and set up the security groups for and do all this other crazy hacking and hot upgrades and distillery and blah, 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 blah. Turns out, just change a couple of config files and upload it to GigElixir and the thing just freaking runs and scales and clusters like exactly like it does now. And I don't even have to think about it. So it's only a matter of time before I just totally smoke those AWS servers and move it over to GigElixir. So that's going to be cool. More updates as that comes along. So
that's pretty exciting because you sent me the README and you're like, well, I think this is it. And it was 1 and 2.
Yeah, basically. It set up the config files and push it.
Right.
Or
that's
the
cool.
Environment variables. Yeah, it's great. It's love how it's all self-contained.
If I didn't have 1,000 other priorities right now, then I would probably try it out.
One day at a time.
That's how I have to live my life right now.
Yeah, so tell me about it. What's been going on?
Well, what's up? Well, I alluded to that this week has been rough, and it's a few things, I think. But the main thing is that I am three weeks into feature land, or into like single, like massive project land. And I think that's part of it. And I'm getting to the part now where there's a lot of moving parts that I'm having to juggle, or I'm having like a lot of things are changing. And so testing is becoming a lot of click testing at the same time. And it's getting more difficult to manage, like keeping everything in mind all at once, keeping all the change sets in mind all at once. That's probably what it is. And that's mostly what I wanted to talk about today, was just project management and managing a project that runs a long time. And in my terms here, a long time is a month and a half, 2 months. And managing a project that touches your core infrastructure and changes things that are core to your application.
Well, yeah. So let's get into the topic. Maybe you can relate it back to what you've been working on recently.
Yeah, yeah. So most recently, I've been working on this big shipping update. I think I've kind of talked about it a couple of times, in the past. But yeah. So what we're working on right now is we're making sort of an assumption. It's not, it's always kind of an assumption. We have some numbers to back up our hypothesis here, but in general, I think most people, when they're shopping online, they want to see a number, and then they see the number and then they choose to purchase. If that number changes, if it gets bigger, then in most cases, they will not continue purchasing. It doesn't matter what the number is for. So in our case, you could be buying a couch and you can have it shipped cross country white glove, which means that they'll take the couch into a room of your choosing and they'll remove debris and everything. And that's $300. And that's a steal, $300 to have something shipped cross country and it's white gloved, it's blanket wrapped, you know, it's taken into your room, $300. But someone will say, they're like, I'm spending $3,000 on this couch. I don't want to pay $300 for shipping. And in my mind, I'm like, what? That's a crazy good deal. You know, but in their mind, it's like $300 more than what they're already paying. It's kind of like more of the iceberg coming out of the water, I guess. So the big change that we've been working on for a while now is essentially price masking. So certain stores can opt into this. And if they opt into it, basically what will happen is we've worked with this company to kind of come up with estimated rates, like averages for shipping things cross country. And when you add the product and you're opted into this feature, we'll add an estimated shipping rate to the price of the product. And so when customers are looking at your products, they'll see a larger number than what you set for the price, which is obviously communicated to the store owner in the admin panel and things like that. But that way, when you're shopping on the other side, when you check out, the number doesn't change, doesn't get bigger out the other side.
Right. So it's the Prime model, where the price that you see is the price that you pay.
Yeah,
minus
exactly.
Taxes, basically, at that point. Because it's funny, that was actually my first question, which you kind of already answered. I was wondering, because we're talking about large internal structural changes to your application. And my first question was actually, how do you know when that becomes relevant? Like, how do you know when the time comes to actually do that? And you, again, you already answered it. It's a business decision. It's, you know, you told me before offline, you were looking at the stats and how many people like navigate away at the checkout page because of the, they see the shipping price or something. Like, it's driven by a business decision, and you know, you are a business. It's nothing's more important than those kind of things, especially when you have the data to back it up. So it's, you know, the thing, the refactorings and the restructurings where it's like, you know, designing for change or future feature sets is sometimes more nebulous about like when you actually want to, you know, spend the time to do it. This is pretty concrete. You have a goal in mind. You know what that outcome is going to be. And so you just have to buckle down and do it, especially when, you know, and basically you have to upset all the previous assumptions you've made in your application up to this point.
Yeah, basically. I mean, like, there's, you can look at other companies, I won't say any names, but they spend close to $1 billion on infrastructure because they kind of manage it themselves. And it costs a lot of money. A lot of money for this sort of model. But that's the model that people are used to. And in fact, I was in World Market the other day looking for a rug. And someone was like, oh, you should go on this site here. And the rug is probably $100 cheaper and it only costs $50 to ship it. Well, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, well, yeah, it costs $100 cheaper because this company bought it at a discount from whoever they bought it from. So A, that hurts the end seller. And B, it's $50 shipping because that's what they're choosing to charge you. I mean, it actually doesn't cost $50 to ship this thing.
Oh, sure.
Right. So there's all these, it's interesting, like there's these like ideas, you know, like when someone says, oh, it only costs $50 to ship it. Well, in their mind, it costs $50 to ship an item, but no, I mean, it doesn't cost $50 in fuel, right, to ship something across the United States.
Yeah, you're paying for, I don't know, convenience, for time, for...
Well, I mean, yeah. And so there are a number of different things. Like, obviously, our goal is to help brick-and-mortar stores. And so we're not going to go to brick-and-mortar stores and buy stuff off of them for cheap because they need to move it, right? And so that's one of the models that happens a lot in the furniture industry is that people, these retailers will go to these stores, these brick-and-mortar stores, and say, we'll buy all of your sale merchandise, and the store doesn't really have a choice. They need to move their inventory, so they're gonna sell, right? And then these companies, they turn around and mark it up, and so they advertised it as this price and shipping is $50, but a lot of times shipping is actually built into the price of the product. So anyway, that's what we're working on, because this is what people expect. Shipping, in their mind, shipping is a thing that they don't have to pay for anymore because Amazon, et cetera, right? So we have a shipping partner that we've been working with, and we worked together, we crunched a lot of numbers, and we came up with sort of a table. And that table basically is just a list of averages based off of origin, destination, how much a thing might cost to ship. And it's based off of volume and weight. And from there, we take that estimated price and we built it into the price of the product. So the change is like gigantic because it affects pricing. And that's, to me, even though maybe the surface area isn't gigantic of the pricing stuff, it's money, right? That's always daunting change to me because that's one thing you can't screw up or you really don't want to screw money stuff up. So that made it pretty intimidating. But yeah, I guess like my main topic, really what I wanted to get at was like some practical advice or some things that I'm kind of learning as I'm working through more of these big projects, because that's been sort of my history with Design Collective. Is I inherited a code base from other people, and we've kind of incrementally gone through and worked on these large projects. And so we were just going over our 2019 kickoff call a couple of weeks ago. We were going over all the stuff we added in 2018, and it was like pretty much large features. And so I thought it might be interesting to talk about some of the mistakes I've made, some things I've learned, just in working on big projects that affect the core infrastructure of an app.
Sure, absolutely. And so like when you're presented with this project and you know this is a pretty, I'll say it's limited in scope in the sense that like you know what the end goal is. You know what's going to happen when you're done, right? Mm. Sometimes a project is kind of like nebulous, like, hey, let's improve sales. And it's like, you know, there's no how or, you know.
Yeah.
But this is like a very definite thing. It's like, hey, let's build shipping price into the price that shows up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably, you know, oversimplifying, but that's the end goal. You'll know it's done when that's done.
Yeah, and this is something we've been ticking around for a while. It's just now that we've kind of worked up a solution. So we knew that the end goal of price masking is going to be a thing. We just weren't sure how to get to that point. And so now we have a shipping partner that we can work with to do this. And so we're actually doing sort of a pilot program. We're helping them get this figured out on their side as well, because, you know, they can offer a similar service to other customers as well.
Is this a new shipping service previous to one that we've talked about before?
Nope, same on one. Same one. Okay. They're just adding to their offerings, I suppose.
So how do you even like begin this process? Given this huge, you know, on the surface it looks simple. You and Paul internally know you dread this because it's a huge undertaking. How do you even start?
Well, so it's funny. This is kind of a non-standard case because, again, the idea of doing this has been around for a while. Like, we knew this was going to be something that we were going to be doing. It's just kind of figuring out how to get there. So I've mentioned before that we use Google Docs a lot. And in this case, we've had a Google Doc hanging out specifically for this feature. And we had already outlined some of the business requirements, like how it should work, essentially. And so I guess really it started a while back with a spec document or like a feature specification document. And it was broken up into a few sections. Like, we have a summary section. So that just kind of in layman's terms breaks down like, this is what this thing does and this is why. Then we have business requirement section. So more specifically, like, this is why A, B, and C need to be happening, or how it should work and why it should work from a business standpoint. And then we had some more user stories. And so this is where Paul did some diving into numbers. And so one thing we've been trying to do is just have more analytics. And it's not like the creepy, like, user kind of analytics. It's like looking at the data we have, looking at the orders, completed orders, not completed orders, how far along through the checkout did they get, at which stage did they leave, looking at funnels and stuff. And so with some of the user stories, we went out, like, why would someone leave at the delivery preference phase? You know, that's when they're going to see how much shipping would cost. And so we tried to think about, from the user standpoint, you know, why would they jump off here? And then underneath that, we had implementation details, which was pretty much empty because we hadn't started or had a solution for it. And so that's generally what all of our documents look like. Is a summary, a business requirement section, user stories, implementation details.
So you're literally looking at it, it's structured from the highest level possible to the lowest level possible before you get to code, right? It's iteratively more detailed in how you're going to do it. I like that because everyone looking at the document can associate with a particular level and above.
Yeah. So let me actually just send you a screenshot real quick. So yeah, I can't put this in the show notes because it has... you're privileged. I'll just, yeah, you're, if you, I know where you live. I'll just say that. I know where you live, Rockwell. Anyway, yeah. So you can see like the implementation detail is 3 pages long, for this specific feature. And it really goes into detail. And so, and this, I guess, like, this is one of the first things I've kind of taken away from learning how to break things up or work on these features is you got to break the feature into like manageable phases or steps. And so in the implementation detail section, I have 1A and B in my case, which would probably be 1 and 2. But I have, you know, step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4. And so this is for me as much as it is for my coworkers. So like step 1 might be like, is there anything database wise that has to change before I can even start working on the front end, you know? And so all this implementation detail stuff, I try to flesh it out as much as I can before I even write code. And that's one of the hardest things, is sometimes you just want to jump into the code and start working. But I found it's really, really beneficial to spend as much time as I possibly can just writing in a Word doc, outlining any edge cases, outlining, breaking it into like steps, like this one hat needs to happen before 2, which needs to happen before 3, etc. And spending as much time as I can there and kind of fighting that itch to just jump into code and start working.
And how do you handle the case where you don't know what the detail is. Like, what if you, I don't know, maybe there's a, not necessarily like a deal breaker, but something that you can't see all the way through to the end until you actually do it. How do you handle that kind of situation?
So
do you just punt it?
Yeah, I kind of stole this from Paul a little bit, but I use emojis, which some people might roll their eyes because it's not really like finding a solution to that problem or like figuring out a solution to that point where you're stuck. But I use kind of three different emojis. So as I'm working on this list, I'll use a gray square for something that needs to be done. I use a green check mark for something that has been done. And then I use a red question mark for something I don't know yet. So it could be like a question. It could be a, this could cause a problem sort of thing, like a watch out sort of thing. But I've heard some people be like, oh yeah, you know, at that point you can probably jump into code and just like write some scratch code and maybe that's okay too. But I find that once I'm there, I tend to leak into actually doing other things beyond solving that scratch problem. So I kind of like put a marker in the sand, so to speak. I use one of my red emojis and move on. I just make a note of it and move on.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that when you have more context later on, it's then you can, you know.
Right,
flush that out.
Right. So there's been a few times where I got to that point and I thought to myself, well, this is kind of a showstopper. I need to get into code and figure this out. And then I go over to Paul and be like, hey, what do you think? And he'd be like, he'll have the other part of my brain that's like, oh, that's been solved. Or here's a simple solution. Like it's not as big a thing as you thought it was. Right.
Okay.
Which happens a lot. So again, that's nice because I have not everyone has, like, there's a lot of indie devs and solo devs out there, but even just like taking those pain points, or I don't even know what to call them really, just like stopping points or places where you get stuck, and showing them to someone else, rubber ducking with somebody, talking to somebody on Slack, whatever. Half the time, and I'm not exaggerating when I say half the time, it's like it's actually not as complicated as I thought, or there's been an easier solution than what I was thinking of. Yeah, so that's maybe the thing that's helped me the most is just being as detailed as I can in a document, just writing and writing. And really, I've had coworkers come up to me and say, like, this is super helpful to them too. And I think more specifically, they're talking about like the gray square, green checkmark thing, where as I go through and complete items, I'm kind of, we used to use Trello and we don't anymore. Everything's kind of consolidated to Salesforce, mainly because that's what our coworkers use. And so I'd rather it be central for them and me have to do a little bit extra work than force them to work how I want to. And so the Google Doc implementation details almost turned into like a checklist, like a Trello checklist, where as I write the things that need to be done down, I put the gray square. And then as I do them, I make a green check mark. And so that way each day, Scott can get in this document because he's planning a marketing push around this. So he can get in the document and see exactly where I'm at, which has been nice.
Another way you can do this, which I also kind of like if you're kind of in the GitHub ecosystem, is creating an issue. So here you've got 1, 2, and 3. Each of those 1, 2, and 3 to me would be one issue, or maybe like a PR, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then your green checkboxes and stuff are actually checkboxes, to-dos in the issue itself. And then you can kind of see the progress of the issue from the top level. It shows you the percentage,
mm-hmm.
right? That I kind of like that. That seems to work out well for me. And then you can, when you do your commits, then you can reference that issue as well, which is nice. But just another way to handle the same thing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a really good idea. Okay, so aside from breaking the large project into smaller phases or steps, another pitfall, another thing that I've kind of learned the hard way is just to sleep on stuff. And I've talked about this over and over again about how, especially Design Collective, I feel like I get into rush mode sometimes. Like, we're a small company, so we got to beat the competition to whatever they're doing, you know, which that's a whole nother discussion. But I still get into that feeling of I have to hurry up and rush and be on top of things all the time. And that's led me to unknown, untold numbers of just stupid issues, you know? And so, I mean, all of us as programmers have heard it's not really an adage, but like, you get stuck, take a break, come back, and you'll solve it in 10 minutes. And it's, what's funny is that I've experienced this many, many times, but I'm still stubborn.
So many times.
I'm still stubborn. And yeah, and so that's another thing that's really helped me, is just trying to remember that. And especially, I mean, there's been a lot of small decisions that had to have been made in this project. And I mean, even down to like, how do we communicate this? Do we say free shipping? Do we say shipping included? Like, what do we say? If someone chooses to check out, you know, obviously it's cheaper because now they don't have to pay for shipping. How do we show that to them? What's the best way to do that? So there's like these marketing, these design things. And also there's the architectural changes as well. Now it's like, okay, we have an estimated rate in, do we care if we lose money on a shipment? Obviously I think the most important thing is that the price doesn't change. So if some orders we make money on it and some orders we lose on it, that's just going to have to be how it is. And so that was like a decision that we had to talk about and you know, to think of, because you don't want to be like, oh, the price is $500. Ha, just kidding. We need another $100 from you before you check out, you know?
Yeah, no, that's no good.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And so like, obviously that's a little bit an easier decision to be made there, but there's been, I'm trying to think now, my brain is shot. There's been some architectural decisions that Paul and I were kind of like spinning our wheels on, because hilariously enough, he's also working on a pretty large change to the other side of the shipping spectrum. And so we can't really price mask our parcel shipments because there's not an API provider that can be like, here's a table rate. You know, you kind of have to send them an origin and destination to get a price back. And so there's been some decisions that Paul and I were like going back and forth on. How do we design this? How do we make it flexible for the future? How do we, you know, our current shipping partner is doing this. How do we make this happen in a way that in the future, if there's another shipping partner that wants to get involved, how do we make that possible without having to rewrite stuff again? You know, so we purposely, when we were figuring out the deadline for this project, we came up with the number and then we added a few weeks to it on purpose so that we would have time to sleep on it, you know? And again, it's one of those things where you're kind of fighting against the need to hurry, the fear of like someone else is going to beat you to it sort of thing. We're trying to fight that and think about like, no, we have to do this right. We have to figure out how to solve this the best that we can, so that way it's not an issue in the future, you know? So we added a few weeks on it so that we would have the luxury of being able to say, yeah, I don't know right now. Let's think about it overnight. Let's take the night. Let's like get some rest, think about it fresh in the morning. And that's been a huge help.
Yeah. It's amazing just how separating yourself from it, how you get a totally different perspective, come back to it about how even important certain things are.
Yeah.
Right. Like in the moment, something you're working on is the most important thing because you're working on it right now and needs to get done. And come back to it a day or a week later. And, you know, you've been dealing with other fires and it helps you prioritize for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been really nice. It's been really nice. Again, it's hard fighting that creeping feeling of someone else is going to eat your lunch or whatever. I don't know. I've heard so many different sayings about that stuff, but it's been as thinking about my personal health and how I feel about the company and how I feel about work, it's been a huge help for me this year already. And that was one of the things I wanted to work on in 2019, was just slowing down a little bit and taking my time and watching out for myself, because if I'm feeling better, if I'm getting rest, then my work's going to be better. There's going to be less mistakes. The work's going to be done. It's just going to be a higher quality of work, I think. And so It's been really helpful. Sleep on it. Sleep on it. So my next point kind of piggybacks on the whole sleep on it idea. And sleeping on it can sometimes cause problems because you can decide to sleep on it and then the next day you cannot remember where you were.
Oh no.
Where you left off, right? Like what problem you're trying to solve and all that stuff. And this kind of goes along with like working in a remote company as well. This is just something you have to do with other people is over communicate. And I've found that it's really helpful for myself as well, over communicating to myself. And so Paul and I do this thing all the time where we'll be doing a code review or we'll be looking at something that the other person wrote. And then like actually today, you know, I sent him some code and he asked a question and I was like, yeah, I will document this for our future selves. And so I kind of treat my future self as another employee altogether.
See, I see it the opposite way. I see my past self as an asshole.
Mm. Yeah. So you're just on the other side of the coin. You're the future self and I am the past self currently.
Yeah, I'm just always mad. I'm always just mad at my past self for not helping out future self, which is me.
Yeah. So I try to treat future self as another employee. And so I try to communicate to that person as well through, I don't know, leaving code comments or explaining things in layman's terms. And I've heard people argue against like commenting code. The code should be self-documenting, but I strongly believe that. Obviously, you shouldn't like this if else statement is seeing if this is true. Well, yeah, I can see that, but why is it seeing it's true, right? So it's like, it's more like leaving the why. You're documenting the why is this happening this way. And one thing practically that I'll do is I use Notion quite a bit. And so I have different HQ pages. So I have a DK HQ page, and at the bottom of the HQ page, I'll just leave a note for the morning. And it just details what I was doing, what I got stuck on, possible ideas of how to fix it. And so when I get there in the morning, I'll look at it, be like, okay, this is where I was stuck. Here's what I was thinking of, which it's usually never one of those things that I write, which ends up being the fix. But basically, it's like I'm writing a Slack message to myself in the morning. And when I get there, or writing email, whatever you need to do, it's like I get there and then I receive the message and I'll be like, oh, cool. Now I'm on the same page. It's like you're filling in one of your other coworkers. It's the same as if I were to work on a feature and I was going to hand it off to Paul, I would probably write him a message detailing where it's at, what's been done, what needs to be done, et cetera. I just do that to myself.
Have you ever done journaling for your work?
Yeah.
Because that's a system that works for a lot of people. It's like at the end, maybe at the end of every day, you kind of just summarize what you've done and what you want to do tomorrow. And like that just takes a couple minutes. But cumulatively over time, you can build up a really good picture. What did I work on this week? What did I work on this month? What did I work on this year? Right. Mm-hmm. And that small amount of work kind of builds up to a nice compendium of knowledge, and sometimes you can get little hints by looking back through that. I don't know if that's helpful for you, but I know it's helped, you know. Jess does that at her work.
Sure.
And that's how she, you know, and then she uses that at the end of the week. She'll just put it in the email and send it to her boss to be like, hey, here's what I did this week, you know.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think for developers, sometimes you kind of take advantage of GitHub changelogs and commit histories and stuff, and especially in Slack. So my boss is in our robot channel. It's so funny. She's in our robot channel in Slack. And we try to be descriptive. Again, we treat our commit messages like someone else is going to read them. And so our boss will read them in the Slack and she'll like be like, yeah, that's awesome. Or it sounds great. I love this idea or something. Even though it's literally just a webhook sending to Slack saying I committed some code, which is, you know, we take advantage of that because it's kind of automated for us a little bit. But I think there's something to be said for taking the time for reflection yourself. And so I laughed a little bit when you asked me about a journal, because I do a CTO journal and it's a weekly thing. And I just have a table in one of my Notion pages where I have a BeThink notification that comes in on Friday and it says, hey, do your CTO journal. And so in that journal, I'll just write down like how the week went, what I worked on, how I thought it went, or like, you know, what I thought went well, what I didn't think went well, what I can improve upon, et cetera. And so I just do that on Fridays.
Okay, cool. So today I learned. I didn't even, I was not baiting you into that question.
Right,
I honestly
right.
didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't tell anybody I do that. It's kind of funny. That's why I laughed a little bit when you said that.
I know you.
Yeah, I don't know. It just helps me become a better employee, I think, because I look back and I mean... If you don't look at history, I guess you're doomed to repeat it is a saying, right? And so if there are things I think I need to improve upon, but I don't ever circle back to those and evaluate how I'm doing, how am I supposed to improve?
Yeah, it's hard to keep all that mentally in your head when you're just trying to focus on the day to day and you lose sight of the big picture and the progress there that you're making one way or another.
Well, yeah, it's like a practical example. So I used to teach guitar lessons, and one of the things I had students do was I would tell them to record their practices. Just get a phone out, whatever, record yourself saying like, all right, this is whatever scale at BPM and play it, and just record your practices, even if it's not every day, if it's once a week, that's something. And so in 6 months, you can go back and listen to a practice that you did 6 months ago, and it's like night and day. You can tell all these like little things that changed that you would never realize. And it can get discouraging when you're trying to learn how to play and you don't feel like you're making any progress, because music is like, I guess like anything, there's plateaus. You make a lot of progress and then you hit the wall, and you make a lot of progress and you hit the wall, and hitting, like climbing over that wall is the most work. But having sort of the recordings that you can fall back and look at, it keeps you going in a sense. And so that's what I feel like my CTO blogging is helping me do, is keep going, I guess. It sounds really bad when you say it that way, but I don't know. It helps me a lot.
What's that? There's that famous quote. Winston Churchill. If you're going through hell, keep going.
That's a pretty fitting statement for working on the plumbing of an application. Sometimes it feels like sometimes. But yeah, so what do we have? We have, so far I've talked about breaking things into manageable phase, like breaking projects into phases, small phases and steps, sleep on it, over communicate, treat your future self like another person. My next, I guess, tip or thing that I try to keep in mind is like mind my scope, mind my feature creep, I guess, is another way I could put it. Because especially in my code base, there are plenty of to-dos and things I want to fix, things I want to re-engineer. And it can be really easy, especially if you're working on a change that affects things on a core level, because you probably have to make a lot of changes in different places, right? And so if you're going to be working on a feature where you're in a lot of different places in your app for that feature, you're going to be seeing lots of things you want to change, but you got to not do that, and you have to stay focused. And so what I've done in the past is see lots of things I want to change and be like, oh, you know, I can make a pull request and like pull that in there, and I can maybe include this in a commit here. Then pretty soon you've slap chopped the app up into something you can't put back together. You know, you just got to throw the branch away. Like I've done that before. And I'm not like, obviously I'm not advocating, you know, people just letting their code base dilapidate and not like tending the garden, so to speak. But if you're working on weeding out the tomatoes and the grapes, maybe don't like re-engineer how you put the cucumbers in there too at the same time. Do that as another project.
I don't know what happened to this analogy. From slap chop to wrenches to gardens.
Yeah, yeah.
You lost me, but
you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, just mind the change set. You know, like if there's something that needs to be fixed, fix it later. Fix it on a Friday. Do it in different branch. Do a separate pull request. Don't just
refactor Fridays.
I mean, like as you're going throughout the day, you might think, oh yeah, this is like a 2-line change. I might as well just commit this in. And then pretty soon you have 10 of those. And I think that the commit history should probably be more specific to the feature than having lots of these small tangential things that'll get lost in the history somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's one thing that I've done maybe to an extreme is, you go to fix one thing and then you've like done something completely else.
Yeah. And you gotta stay focused on that. I'm very guilty of this, but actually on a much even larger scope. So like when I was putting off rewriting the front end for RHR. I kept putting it off because I was like, well, if I redesign the back end so it knows about the front end and like structures its data in such a way that like makes the front end really, really, really easy to write, then I'll kind of fix, you know, two birds with one stone, right?
Yeah.
But then it was just too much. It was too much. Like too much was changing. There's no way I could deploy it. Because like it involves redeploying the entire system from scratch, and like you can't test that, mm-hmm. right? With us, where like we have individual stations, right? Physical hardware stations. They can only be on the old system or the new system. They can't be on both. And like, you know, you can't. There's no migration path there. And so like, yeah. Once I focused in and was like, okay, I'm gonna stick with my old cruddy. And by cruddy, I don't mean crud. I mean like bad. My old cruddy backend server interface that is based in, you know, 2012 thinking. But just do the front end. And you know what? Here we are. It's actually, people are actually using it now, right? That's progress. And now, if I wanted to, I could start migrating some backend servers over and it'd be nicer. But like, you know, one thing at a time. I'm definitely need to work on that, getting in that mindset. You know, yeah. you go down one path and you realize how much work things really are, and you just burn out.
Yep. That's an accurate statement, because I've definitely been there. So yeah, I mind the feature scope. I mean, like developers are highly aware of feature creep from the other side, where someone comes in and starts ballooning a feature, feature requirement, right? But if we're the ones ballooning it, it's a little bit easier to let pass or to kind of like let fly under the radar. But I don't know, it's beneficial to try and keep the change set, even if you're passing over some things that need to be cleaned up, keep the change set focused. And it'll, especially if it's a big feature, it's a big project, those little changes add up. They really, really add up, and it really pays dividends in the end to keep things focused and concentrated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what do we got now? Let's go back over it again. We got writing. Write things down, break things up into phases, sleep on it, over communicate to your future self, Mind the Scope. And maybe the last one I can talk about today is As You Go. I don't, it might sound like this flies directly opposite to what I just said. But one thing that's been very useful in this specific project is kind of drying up core functionality. And by that, I mean, when it was just me working on Design Collective, it was very hard to spend ample time on features. And so you kind of just get like, you get like this pile of clay where you had a nice bowl at once, and then you just like slapped a piece of clay on here, and you slapped a piece of clay on there, and you slapped another piece over here. And so what's been really nice is kind of taking a minute. So one of the steps in my implementation details was about actually sort of a refactor that was involved in the project. And the reason why I wanted to do this refactor was because it directly affects a lot of the work that will come after it. So it made sense to kind of do this here. It didn't feel like a feature or a project creep, so to speak, but it felt like this sort of refactor needs to happen before I get to the other part, because it'll make my life a lot easier down the road, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's an old expression for that. Make the change easy, then make the easy change.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it.
But you don't want to follow that too much, because then you fall into the trap of the previous thing we talked about, which was, you know, you start refactoring everything.
Right. I mean, if it makes sense for the feature that you're working on, it makes sense to do it then.
Yeah.
But don't add other refactor things into the project that shouldn't be there. In our case specifically, there were just some different pricing things that were, like, all the math wasn't contained to one spot. And that was something I've always wanted to do, was just move it all to, like, a pricing module that handles all the logic for you. You give it a product and it says, here's the price for this user, for example. Give it a product and user, it returns the price for that user. So it takes into account any discounts, any user discounts, any roles, stuff like that, right? So that's kind of what the pricing module does. And so what I did was I just moved the rest of the stuff that should be there into that spot.
Right. And then you had a basis on which to build the new pricing stuff, which is all pricing related. So it made sense to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And like all the tests are in one place. It just made it easy. So before we have and this is kind of Elixir specific, but we had these change set modules that had, you know, functions like put price and cents, put tax and cents, whatever. So it takes a change set, it pulls what it needs out of the change set, and then it calculates tax, price, whatever, and then it puts it back into the change set and then continues on, right? And so since we had a few of those change sets, we sort of had some duplicated logic here and there. And what I ended up doing was taking the duplicated logic, moving into pricing, and then calling pricing from the change set modules themselves. So there's still individual functions in the change set for put price and cents, put tax and cents, because it's a step that change set has to go through. It's just that the logic was moved to a central location.
Yeah, that's the beauty of functional programming, is you can just move stuff around wherever you want.
Oh, yeah, it's so nice.
Yeah, you don't have any implicit state.
Yeah, and so for example, going from tallying, like having a tally, an order tally coming from line items, instead of that happening, now they have to go through order shipments, because now if an order is a pickup order, then the total is going to be different, right? So there's new logic that wasn't there before. And so I would basically have to copy and paste, which, you know, they say it's fine to copy and paste a couple of times, and after that, then dry it up. And so that's kind of the step that I went through, was I just dried that up. And so it isolated that. It's not even scary logic. Again, it deals with money, and that's why I'm paranoid about it. But it isolates all of my insecurities and fears into one module, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and my thoughts about this, which I put in the notes here, was minimizing the surface area of a feature, right? So when you this is the whole crux of design patterns, right? Is making you be able to swap things out and represent things in kind of a known way. And making things kind of interchangeable, right? In an object-oriented world, it's a very big topic, right? You've got all kinds of patterns involving objects and functions and delegation, and there's all kinds of patterns, right? But with Elixir, and again, we're talking kind of specifics here, with Elixir and any kind of functional language, you just have functions and data, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have anything else inherently. And so minimizing the surface area is going to sort of limit your vectors for problems,
right?
Right. It limits the things you have to test. It limits problems that can go wrong. It limits things you have to think about in your head, and that's that's kind of something that I've learned over time, is just not trying to write everything first, is just writing it, adding things as I need them, very, mm-hmm. very minimally, and trying to reuse what I already have if at all possible. And I think that's important in this case where you know, like you said, it is so important to get that functionality right. And you don't want it to be spread out in a bunch of different places and have a bunch of different functions and modules and arguments and options. And it just gets messy real quick with all your different permutations. So,
yeah, I mean, before it was much easier because we didn't really have anything computed on the front end. I don't mean in a JavaScript front end. I mean, like, we didn't have any computed values in terms of money, because the price was the price of a product. And so now a price can change based off of a store setting, for example. So one thing we didn't want to do was say if a store that has 10,000 products decides to not do this anymore, then they flip that switch and then we have to update 10,000 rows in database, but also update the search index for all 10,000 products and say they switch it back. Because a lot of our customers sometimes do that. They'll switch settings back and forth just to see what happens. And so that's a bad thing. You know, it would cascade. It might take a little bit of time. I mean, a little bit of time being a few seconds, but who knows, like, thinking about eventually having a little bit more scale, that's not something we wanted to do, right? So now we sort of have this idea of a computed value, which is a price of a product based off of a setting. And so that math has to be done at runtime instead of at storage, if that makes sense. We didn't have that before because it was all just simple. It was simpler, and now it's a little bit less simple. And so what we did was we consolidated that logic and test into one spot. So
sure, you kind of made the shift from declarative to imperative, basically.
Yeah.
Your functions became your accessors for that value, as opposed to just getting the value.
Right. Exactly. And it's working out great. Like, it's, what's funny is that I wasn't worried, but I wasn't necessarily I'm looking forward to having this done, but I wasn't looking forward to doing it because I knew it was such an expansive change. But really solving a lot of those problems before I even got to the code, just in writing in a Word doc and going over that with Paul over a couple of days, that made so much of it easier and less daunting. It really, really did. And I used to not think that it would make that much of an impact. I used to do it mainly for the business rules and those things like that, so those can get like codified somewhere. But really, like on this project, I really saw the benefit of spending that time in writing out pseudocode and writing out pseudo solutions in plain English in a document, and then sitting on that and then coming back to it. And then once I got into the code, it was less scary. I don't know how else to describe that. But
well, when you're writing code, you want to be in the mode where it's as literally as fast as you can write it.
Yeah.
You don't want to be stopping and thinking about things.
Yeah.
And by having your business decisions and, you know, again, like you said, pseudocode already done for you, it's the process just goes a lot faster when it actually comes time to do the actual quote-unquote work.
Right.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm glad it's working out for you. I really liked going through this sort of story of your process here. No, it's cool. It's really enlightening, and I hope our listeners have got something out of it as well. I know I have.
Yeah, I mean, it's been this stuff, like, a lot of it seems kind of like, oh yeah, duh, you know, like, oh yeah, break it into phases, sleep on big decisions, you know, over-communicate. But when you're in the thick of it, when you're actually looking at the wall, it's hard to like see around the wall, see over the wall, see under it, whatever, see through it. And it can be, especially a feature of this magnitude and scope, and it touches so many things, you can just see the feature as just just a blob, like something you can't see past. And some of those common sense things go out the window because you're kind of blinded by that, right? And I don't know. Again, like, I talk about reflection a lot, but like taking time at the end of the week to reflect on this stuff, how looking at this feature made me feel before and after writing an implementation detail doc, you know, taking notes on that stuff. And I think it helps it get into my brain memory, like my muscle memory, but for my brain, I guess, if that makes any sort of sense. But yeah, it's been a big journey, and I'm actually like really happy with how things are turning out so far. I'm happy with like the time. I'm actually ahead of schedule, knock on wood, ahead of schedule, feeling good about things.
Cool. And you know, the app's only getting more complicated, so you're just gonna be doing this more often, probably.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is like it's getting more complicated right now because Paul's working on a bin packing solution for parcel shipments. So that's that. There's that.
Oh yeah, you told me about that. That sounds wild.
We can go. We have our first microservice, actually. So it's a thing. There's a reason. We can go into that another day. We can go into the whole project once it's finished. But
that's another topic.
But yeah, we're adding a bin packing layer to make our parcel shipments through Easy Post smarter and more accurate. So yeah,
playing Tetris
at the same time as I'm working on price masking and. We can do like a feature breakdown of this, like how we implement, like how technically how I implemented this stuff, because it's kind of cool how it works now. So we have on a very, very, very short story of this, we have the idea of a rate provider, and a rate provider just has an interface that it adheres to. And so if we have to do custom coding for that rate provider, it's fine. So like maybe a new rate provider comes along and they have an API for estimated rates. Whereas our current one just gave us a spreadsheet and I made that into database tables, right? As long as the output of that conforms to the interface, we're golden. Like you can just insert that into the stack and not have to touch the front end at all and it'll just work.
Cool. That's design patterns 101,
right?
It's cool.
Yeah. But I'm feeling a little bit less like this week was just super rough and I'm feeling better about things after talking about it. So thank you for that.
Re-energized?
A little bit, yeah.
Cool. That's good.
Yeah. So if anybody has any feedback or ideas or practical advice on what else to do, like how you guys approach problems, large projects, things that touch sensitive things in the application, I would really love to hear about it.
Yeah, we're going to be a little more active on the DNC show Twitter. We're going to be signing our individual tweets with our initials so you can know who's tweeting at you. So we'll be checking that frequently. The Twitter username is at DNC show, as always. If you want to tweet us directly, Sean is Sean Washbot, and myself, I am Shrockwell.
And show notes will be available at dnc.show. And usually I put links up there and sometimes I put animated GIFs and fun things in there. I think one time I put a link to the entire Goofy movie. So if you want to have a good time, head over to dnc.show and check out the show notes there.
We also post the show notes on spectrum.chat. And you can also reach us over there to have some discussions about the show, ask any questions, or just yell at us. I don't know why you do that. Please don't.
Yeah, if you're looking for a job, you can head over to spec.fm/jobs and check out what's going on there. They've got some jobs posted from some really cool companies. So if you're looking or even thinking about looking, definitely head over to spec.fm/jobs and check it out. And as always, thanks to the Spec for having us. We're really, really happy that they keep us around. They haven't kicked us to the curb yet. And we're happy to be in good company with other shows like Design Details and Fragmented and Swift Unwrapped. If you haven't checked those out yet, you really should. If you're into design and developer-related podcasts, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.
Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson. All right, I got to get back to playing with these NeoPixels.
I'm going to go put something in the pressure cooker.
Ooh, sounds good.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
See ya. Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Don't wait for your users to report errors. Iterate faster, improve customer happiness, and make a better product with Sentry's comprehensive error reporting platform. Check them out at sentry.io.
Boom, boom.